your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Gosh, tonight we've got one of the finest guests with us, Tony Gosling, out of Bristol. Yeah, you laugh, but you are, Tony. Welcome to our program, Tony, and tell our listening audience a little bit about you.
Well, first of all, thanks very much, George. My background is in the aviation business, the family business, based at Biggin Hill, which was one of the airfields which was at the front line in the Battle of Britain. Down in Kent, you know, sort of really trying to protect London from the bombing raids during the Blitz, etc., which came a little bit after that. But, I mean, it really was an important time for Britain to try and turn back the airborne assault from the Nazis and, you know, on our own, really, pretty much, as we were back in 1939-1940. Anyhow, then I got into broadcasting. I suppose I found flying a bit boring, really, and I wanted something which is going to be a bit more of a challenge day to day. And of course, journalism generally is exactly that. And it's a constant education, George. This is the thing I find, is I love to share with my listeners new things I've uncovered, particularly to do with the twisting of history and the way that, you know, there's this thing that's been going on for centuries and centuries, hasn't it? History is written by the winners. Encapsulated by Winston Churchill in the wonderful phrase, history will be kind to me, I know, because I will write it. Well, I'm...
Man, you come up with good quotes, you know?
And Churchill, you know, we had references to Churchill, didn't we, from Donald Trump, when Theresa May has just come to visit him in the White House. And I know Churchill is, I think, a figure who doesn't deserve to be really respected very much at all because of the treachery that went on at the end of the Second World War, particularly, and to do with the deals done, particularly over the atomic weapons and the Nazi gold. And there was certainly knowledge by Churchill of deals done for the gold, and that was never exposed. He hoped it would never be exposed because it's taken quite a lot of effort by me and a handful of others to expose the truth behind all that. And also worth mentioning that a lot of money seems to have gone into trying to spoil that truth. You know, in other words, to put diversionary mainstream books, you know, in order to divert people away from what really happened. So anyway, I now do. I was trained by the BBC, worked for them for 3 years, and in central London mostly, and you know, in the radio newsrooms. And we were the first. We'd always be the first of the stories. Absolutely loved the job because there was a kind of very healthy competition going on between us and the other London stations to get be the first people to cover events. So then I went on to Bristol in the west of England, settled down there in the mid-1990s, and around about 10 years ago started to do a weekly politics program, really, I suppose, to sort of compete a bit with the local BBC. And in fact, I think we've actually managed to get a load of, several now awards for the radio station. I'm not saying it's just our show, of course, that's doing that, but you know, really to give the BBC a run for their money. Despite all the money they've got to spend on stuff, you know, we're basically a community radio volunteer run affair. I think it's fair to say we're giving them a good run for their money. And every week we have a politician in, a local politician, a councillor or a MP, a member of the European Parliament, somebody like that. And in the first hour and then the second hour, we really do go into the, you know, the more, I think, the sort of stuff that the BBC nationally and internationally should be doing but isn't.
Well, you know, I'll be talking to you, you know, before and after our program sometimes, and you'll always have a book in your hand that I was going to recommend to you or that I was going to want to interview myself, you know, the author. I mean, you've done some very excellent reporting, and you usually make it, not every year, but you like to go to the Bilderberger, at least report on it. Is that right?
That's right. And also, just to let you know, I'm not sure if the news has gone out in Austin yet, but that it looks as if the Bilderberg conference is going to be in the US this year. It's going to be at Chantilly. There's a block booking from the 1st to the 4th of June. Also, I mean, I can't really...
Where will it be now, Tony? Did you know the...
Chantilly, Virginia, the usual Bilderberg US venue, which is in Washington, just outside Washington, D.C. Best place to stay if anyone wants to go. I have to say that this is not confirmed yet. But you might want to make a tentative reservation, so long as you can cancel it and get your money back, at the Hyatt Hotel there at the airport, at Dulles Airport, because that is by far the best place to stay. Everyone tells me who's covered these US Bilderberg conferences, because you get a shuttle bus to the actual hotel where the Bilderberg conference is taking place, and it's very difficult to park anywhere near. So that looks, George, to be the 1st to the 4th of June. I can't swear to it, but... It's not just the block booking of the hotel during those days. It's also a couple of other indications that we, a small group of us over here, have got, who've been going to these Bilderberg conferences and went to Dresden last year, etc. We got some indications from Dresden, etc., that this is where it was going to be, and now it looks that this block booking makes it, I would say, something like 90% certain that that's where it's going to be this year.
Oh man, that's great, Tony. Did you have time to view any of the panel discussions at the World Economic Forum recently?
It was, I think, the most interesting probably was President Xi Jinping. You know, the Chinese leader. His take on all of this is, I think the Chinese are seeming to sort of almost kind of rise to the occasion at the moment. Now, some might see that as threatening, and in fact, you can completely understand why, because it is an authoritarian regime. I'll let you into a little secret. I was approached about a month and a half ago by CCTV, which is the English language China International TV service, 24-hour rolling news service. I was not saying they're headhunting me, but they actually approached me and said, could you please apply for these jobs? And, you know, I just...
Really?
..sent off my CV, yes, as a television news producer there. And they're obviously expanding. They've seen the success of Russia Today, and they realised that they could be next in line. And I did an interview, Skype interview with CCTV for about an hour or so. And at one point in the interview, they said to me, "Well, have you watched China's? Have you watched us? Have you watched our programmes?" And I said, "Yes, I have. It was a little bit difficult. You've got to watch it on YouTube or live online. Obviously, we don't have it. Most of the packages you get here in Britain." And I said, "Well, what do you think of it?" You know, hoping, I suppose, I'd say something positive. I said, "Hey, it's like watching paint dry. It's
really
boring. You know, this is an interview. You remember, I'm just going to tell them like it is, because I think that's the only way to do it." And I said, it was the most boring television channel I've ever seen. And I think you desperately need people who are prepared to speak out rather than just say what they're told to say. If you succeed,
too much of a reading type of thing. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, it's like official government announcements.
Yeah, it's two-step and just a reading of the reports and news. What would you say?
Yeah, it's got no kind of no creative edge to it, no real fun. It's got a bit of fake fun, you know. But it's just so unspontaneous, George. It is horrible. I wouldn't actually recommend any of your listeners even bother watching it. I mean, obviously, if you wanted to just verify what I'm saying, go and have a look. But it's just, you watch it and you think, look, you're just going through a kind of, this is like if a machine or a computer was generating news, this is what it would look like.
It almost sounded like a digital voice thing. You know what I mean? They have robots in there. And
yeah, I mean, and also, of course, this makes a difference. You know, if someone is just reading out what they're supposed to say, then you right. don't, no one will watch it. I said to them, look, you're not going to get an audience if you carry on like this. Look at what RT have done. They've, I mean, they've got some quite, you know, they've they started from scratch, whatever, 10 years ago.
Right.
And they got some people on there. I'm not saying, you know, me, but I mean, several people like me and people who've worked in mainstream broadcasting in the West and some of the presenters too, who are prepared to, you know, push the questions, ask the difficult questions. And, that's brought them an enormous great audience. And particularly their, you know, their YouTube channel, which keeps everything that's been said on there pretty much as a record, apart from a few little things edited out, like the any reference to Putin being bad or any reference to the Chinese, the Russian Communist Party doesn't seem to ever appear on RT, because after all it is a state broadcaster, to a certain extent a propaganda channel.
But the Chinese really
are, they're in a very, very low league when it comes to it. And I just hope that they manage to have a few real journalists working there rather than a bunch of stenographers, you know, just copying out
what
the Communist Party committee has told them to say.
Oh, man. Joseph Stiglitz was at the World Economic Forum in Davos. He said two pretty important things that I came away with. One was that he's pushing a cashless society. You know what I mean?
Certainly. That is
definitely
being pushed, isn't it? Very hard right now.
Right. Right now. And then the second thing he came out with was criticism of the euro, of the single monetary unit for the European Union. He said that was a failure.
Yeah, so what are they going to do now?
So,
they've got this currency all across Europe, and it's
bankrupt. Right.
So what now? Does everyone go back to drachma, to lira?
I think they lost their flexibility. He said that because there was no flexibility in the system, the rigidity is what is killing off the single currency.
I think he's wrong about that, actually, because the US and the IMF, I think, were using the euro as a very simple tool of economic warfare against countries like Spain, Portugal, Greece, Italy.
That southern tier in there, right?
Yeah, and it's an effective way of stripping out their assets, you know, basically using the trade, you know, strong currency versus weak currency. And I think, you know, without going into all the sort of fine detail, most people can see, particularly the Greeks, I mean, they voted, didn't they, back 18 months ago to leave the euro. And they just weren't allowed to leave it, you know.
Right.
Drachma, but they were told they can't, you know, so... yes, absolutely right. But it's not a mistake. It's not a failure. It's a bit like this whole thing of the lose scenario. You know, like Vietnam, apparently, none of the senior people ever intended to win the Vietnam War. They just knew that they were going to lose, but they were going to get what they wanted along the way, which was a domination of that part of the region in order to grow narcotics, in order for a much bigger geopolitical game to be played. I think that, you know, there's very little understanding of this this whole thing. I mean, you could even look at World War II as a lose scenario, where the Nazis, although Hitler didn't probably believe this, most of the people behind it probably thought they never could win against the entire world and have their Third Reich, which was going to completely dominate Europe. But they got what they wanted along the way, which was all the loot that they've used since.
Well, they looted those countries, didn't they, Tony?
Of course they did. But this idea that you go into a conflict, like Afghanistan, there's another one, as a lose scenario, you're going to lose, but you're going to get what you want along the way, which is usually some form of devastation of the country involved, and looting of it, and also, of course, afterwards, making a lot of money through reconstruction. So these, I think, are things which are not really discussed as much as they should be in the mainstream at all. But it's actually, when they go into one of these conflicts, there's no intention of actually really getting what they went into it for in the first place.
No, it's to loot the country. Now, another thing that was behind the scenes but not spoken of that much was the world debt, which I think is reaching $160 trillion or so. But they don't say that much. You know what I mean? But it's gotten worse since 2008, but they're not talking about it much.
I had a really good friend back in the 90s. He was Danish, and he told me about one of their TV presenters. And I just love the story because I wish this would happen more. And he was quite a character, this guy, and he was quite well trusted by the Danes, and they used to love him. You know, he's like we don't really get too many of these characters on our Western TV news as anchors anymore. And at the end of the evening, one evening, he leant into the camera at the end of the bulletin and he said, "And that is what we decided to tell you tonight." And of course, the real truth is exactly what you've just said. These trillions of international debt are never mentioned. The massive hemorrhaging of wealth from the US and Britain, for example, never mentioned.
Right.
The enormous trade deficit. Never mentioned. The, you know, this used to be when I was a young man, kind of, I suppose in my 20s, late teens, every few months you would get a quarterly, what is the trade gap? You know, how much more are we importing than we're exporting? This was always considered to be very important. The government kept control of this. Now we hear nothing about it, nothing at all. And the idea is that all of the key indicators the economic success or failure of our countries are simply never mentioned. It's taboo. It's like living up the South Sea Islands, you know, before the coming of Western man to the Polynesians, where they used to have these crazy taboos. You know, someone would have to never speak about something, and if they did, they'd be killed. All this kind of crazy taboo. And that is actually what the mainstream media is its lifeblood now, is if you break one of those taboos, your career is finished in a day.
Oh man! Hey, your prime minister, the UK prime minister, Theresa May, just recently concluded a visit to our president Donald Trump here. And what are your main comments or impressions of that? I'm going to play a couple of clips in here after we discuss this a little bit, and then I want your comments on the clips too.
All I can tell you, George, is we were laughing out loud yesterday watching this.
Is that right?
Just to see the body language. These two, they look so...
They were holding hands out on the porch.
They looked so uncomfortable, uncomfortable. Well, actually, it was Theresa May that looked uncomfortable with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
She looks almost like a kind of, I would say, either a fish out of water. The pair of them are like chalk and cheese. You've got the, and also the cartoons in the British press were pretty good, actually.
Are they? I bet.
The Times, there was one.
The caricature of the faces and stuff. Yeah.
They're about to meet in the Oval Office, and they're walking towards each other. Theresa May has got her hand outstretched, ready to shake Donald Trump's hand. Donald Trump's hand, however, is aiming at a rather lower spot on Theresa May in order to grab her, you know, sort of way. So that was one from the Times, which was quite good. And in the Guardian.
Oh, I see. Yeah, they're doing that over. I'm going to play one of the clips here we have of Theresa May, and then I want your comments on it, and then we'll discuss that, and then I'm going to play one of
Donald
Trump.
Let me tell you just quickly, the Steve Bell cartoon in The Guardian, I do recommend it's worth a laugh, just a laugh, but the pair of them, just a pair of their feet, lying off the end of the bed, you know, the pair.
Okay.
So, you know, I think this special relationship between Trump and May is supposed to be a special relationship, but the take home from the cartoons and the take home from the real encounter is absolutely that these two, they seem completely incongruous with each other.
Okay, well let me let you play what she has to say, and then we'll come back and hear your comments. Okay, here we go.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. And can I start by saying that I'm so pleased that I've been able to be here today, and thank you for inviting me so soon after your inauguration. And I'm delighted to be able to congratulate you on what was a stunning election victory. And as you say, the invitation is an indication of the strength and importance of the special relationship that exists between our two countries, a relationship based on the bonds of history, of family, kinship and common interests. And in a further sign of the importance of that relationship, I have today been able to convey Her Majesty the Queen's hope that President Trump and the First Lady would pay a state visit to the United Kingdom later this year, and I'm delighted that the President has accepted that invitation. Now today we're discussing a number of topics, and there's much on which we agree. The President has mentioned foreign policy. We're discussing how we can work even more closely together in order to take on and defeat Daesh and the ideology of Islamist extremism wherever it's found. Our two nations are already leading efforts to face up to this challenge, and we're making progress with Daesh losing territory and fighters, but we need to redouble our efforts. And today we're discussing how we can do this by deepening intelligence and security cooperation, and critically by stepping up our efforts to counter Daesh in cyberspace. Because we know we will not eradicate this threat until we defeat the idea, the ideology that lies behind it. Our talks will be continuing later. I'm sure we'll discuss other topics, Syria and Russia. On defence and security cooperation, we're united in our recognition of NATO as the bulwark of our collective defence. And today, we've reaffirmed our unshakable commitment to this alliance. Mr. President, I think you said you confirmed that you're 100% behind NATO. But we're also discussing the importance of NATO continuing to ensure it is as equipped to fight terrorism and cyber warfare as it is to fight more conventional forms of war. And I've agreed to continue my efforts to encourage my fellow European leaders to deliver on their commitments to spend 2% of their GDP on defence so that the burden is more fairly shared. It's only by investing properly in our defence that we can ensure we're properly equipped to face our shared challenges together. And finally, the President and I have mentioned future economic cooperation and trade. Trade between our two countries is already worth over £150 billion a year. The US is the single biggest source of inward investment to the UK, and together we've around $1 trillion invested in each other's economies. And the UK-US defence relationship is the broadest, deepest and most advanced of any two countries, sharing military hardware and expertise. And I think the President and I are ambitious to build on this relationship in order to grow our respective economies, provide the high-skilled, high-paid jobs of the future for working people across America and across the UK. And so we are discussing how we can establish a trade negotiation agreement, take forward immediate high-level talks, lay the groundwork for a UK-US trade agreement, and identify the practical steps we can take now in order to enable companies in both countries to trade and do business with one another more easily. And I'm convinced that a trade deal between the US and the UK is in the national interest of both countries and will cement the crucial relationship that exists between us, particularly as the UK leaves the European Union and reaches out to the world.
Well, Tony, what do you think about that?
Well, first of all, she starts off quite hesitantly.
Right.
And also, I found probably the most amusing part of that is where she's sort of basically putting words into Donald Trump's mouth, getting him to unsay what he said about NATO.
About the NATO. He's not quite that hot on that, is he?
He said NATO's obsolete, basically, didn't he? And he said if he wants
to
be part of it, then everyone else is going to have to start paying their share. You know, so he's effectively saying, you know, he's threatening to pull out of NATO. And that was quite interesting to hear Theresa May saying that you are behind NATO 100%, aren't you, Donald? You know.
Yeah, exactly. Looking over at him. Yeah, yeah.
This discussion about cyber warfare, this, I think, is a really important thing. Everyone should be really aware of what's going on here, because we had the Jens Stoltenberg, Secretary General of NATO, right after the Dresden Bilderberg meeting, talking about this, saying, well, we've got to be prepared for cyber warfare. Russia is preparing to conduct cyber warfare, blah, blah. Actually, the truth of the matter, of course, is that we've got massive capabilities of GCHQ and the NSA to conduct cyber warfare. But the thing is that they wouldn't really be able to hit Russia. They already tried taking out the banks in November, beginning of December in Russia.
They did, didn't they?
And that failed, basically. It was an attempt, so this cyber warfare, I think it may be coming from Russian IP addresses bouncing off them or something, but the real fear for me is that the West is going to be using its capability against dissidents and domestic population here in the UK and the US and in Europe and places like that. So it's very easy, of course, if there is some kind of cyber attack, maybe you're switching off the electricity stations, goodness knows what else, you know, that will all be blamed on Russia, because we couldn't possibly do that to ourselves. Well, I think that's just nonsense. So this is something, you know, we've seen this running ever since that last Bilderberg conference. I think it's quite clear that the military in the West see this as one of the most credible ways to actually get a war of some kind, maybe even a shooting war started.
Right, that they're in Poland now with some of our troops.
By
now.
Saying, look, you're doing cyber attacks on that, that's tantamount
to exactly.
a declaration of war. So also the trade deal that she's talking about there. Britain is desperate for this, of course, because we're just about to start the whole negotiation process for Brexit. And
do you think that's going to be successful through Parliament? Will they vote the Brexit out?
I think certainly will. I can't be 100% sure, but I think it's almost certain that they will vote for that next week. Because
did they not want to be under the thumb of Germany and the dominance of German might trade?
They're not really being given much of an option. I think if Parliament was to vote against this Brexit Act, Brexit bill as it is now,
I think
they would just lose credibility with the population as a whole, and
the government
would make great capital out of that, saying, well, look, we are doing our best to implement what the people wanted, but Parliament isn't, and I don't think this would be good. Also, I noticed that opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn has ordered a three-line whip, which means all of his MPs are supposed to be voting for the bill, which is a very sensible thing for him to do, actually. I think, he's definitely on the right side of history there.
Yeah, the Queen inviting him over there, what's that all about, Tony?
Oh, well, I mean, this is, look, US and Britain, okay, so I often see Britain as a kind of, we've got a lot of good stuff here, but we have also spawned some poisoned children, and one of them is the United States of America over the centuries. And, you know, the US, this whole sort of Declaration of Independence, which is a lot of good things about it, but it's built on all this genocide. We've got a similar kind of thing with the creation of Israel. Britain seems to be really, I mean, England particularly, in London, you know, very good in the city of London specifically, the merchant classes here in Britain, creating, you know, this sort of genocide and the creation of the United States. And then much more recently, obviously, Israel too. So these are very, very close relationships. And I would suggest there's a lot of kind of secret society involvement as well behind.
Yes, I know.
There's absolutely no way that the key people involved in these relationships are ever going to be elected or de-elected from their posts because they're part of the permanent government. The most useful thing you can do if you want to understand how this all works in Israel, Britain, and in the United States is first of all look at Freemasonry, and then secondly look at the P2 Lodge, which was exposed in Italy, which was running Italy in the 1980s, which just shows you all of the police, security services, newspaper editors, bankers, heads of political parties were all basically running the country from a Masonic committee in private houses in the countryside, and saying, well, this person here is going to be as it was at the time in Italy, this bank will be blown up, this person will be kidnapped and assassinated, and the secret services were really the hidden hand behind the scenes. I think there's a similar thing basically going on in the US, Britain, and in Israel particularly. I mean, other countries probably follow a similar model, but I think that's the most clear way I think I can say to look at what's really the relationship between the US and Israel.
Yeah. What I see, there was no agreement on sanctions against Russia. UK is a hardline sanctioned country against Russia, and I think Trump doesn't. He wants to drop those or change them.
Well, certainly does. I mean, looking at his foreign policy, he is. I mean, it's largely, of course, this is coming from Rex Tillerson, and his and Exxon's relationship with the Russian oil companies has got a lot to do.
Right, in the northern Siberia area, yeah.
Absolutely. But, I mean, there's been a couple of articles recently. I was just reading one today in the Independent Online, and there was also Pepe Escobar writing in the South China Morning Post, which is becoming a very... I mean, it's one of those things. If your listeners haven't already, bookmark the South China Morning Post, because a lot of stuff is coming out through that outlet about the emerging conflict between the US and China. I think the headline was "The War with China Under Trump." Oh no, this is what one of the spokespeople said: "The war with China under Trump is becoming a practical reality." He even said, "This is a defense ministry spokesperson from China says, war could break out tonight." We're moving to that kind of situation. The headline itself was China.
It's that South China Sea controversy.
There are several places, aren't there? This is the thing over there where the conflict is starting to brew up. We've got the South China Sea, we've got the Korean Peninsula, we've got Taiwan, and Trump ending this one China policy. Now, don't take that
right,
this
right,
is really
right.
Important stuff because, you know, as soon as you start recognizing Taiwan and start chatting about Taiwan. This is just winding the Chinese up. Something chronic.
Yeah, it is. The Chinese are upset about that.
This is bound to, you know, don't wind things up. Let's not wind things up, because I don't know if you've seen it, but there's this John Pilger film out just before Christmas called The Coming War with China, which is a 2-hour-long film, and it is the sort of thing that should be broadcast almost permanently on its own channel. Because what he's doing there is he's showing exactly what's been going on over the last 20, 30 years around the periphery of China. Now, we're most of us familiar with the fact that there's been a build-up of military bases around Russia, but the same thing has been going on around China, and this is really winding the Chinese up. I think John Pilger's one of the... I mean, he was an outstanding filmmaker back even to the era of the Vietnam War, but this is his latest effort, and, I mean, for example, he goes through some of the scares there were in the Cuban Missile Crisis with the near launch of the nuclear force towards China, only stopped by some very smart US officer with a gun saying, don't fire these nuclear weapons because we haven't got a conflict with China. Yeah, the Cuban Missile Crisis is about Russia, not China, so we can't fire these weapons against China. This is ridiculous. Must be an erosion.
We've got to keep Russia and China apart, so we can't be too aggressive against Russia. See, that's it. Hey, now I'm going to play this Trump response. Okay. At the press conference with May, okay? That's coming up right now. Give me a sec.
Okay.
You said you'd help us with a Brexit trade deal. You said you'd stand by us with NATO. But how can the British Prime Minister believe you? Because you have been known in the past to change your position on things. And also, May, that's a question to both of you. People are fascinated to know how you're going to get on with each other. You're so different. The hard-working daughter of a vicar, the brash TV extrovert... Have you found anything in common personally yet?
Actually, I'm not as fresh as you might think. and I can tell you that I think we're going to get along very well. You know, it's interesting because I am a people person. I think you are also, Teresa. And I can often tell how I get along with somebody very early, and I believe we're going to have a fantastic relationship. Brexit, and I really don't change my position very much. If you go back and you look, my position on trade has been solid for many, many years, since I was a very young person, talking about how we were getting ripped off by the rest of the world. And I never knew I'd be in this position where we can actually do something about it. But we will be talking to your folks about Brexit. Brexit was an example of what was to come. And I happened to be in Scotland at Turnberry, cutting a ribbon when Brexit happened. And we had a vast amount of press there. And I said, Brexit, this was the day before, you probably remember, I said, Brexit is going to happen. And I was scorned in the press for making that prediction. I was scorned. And I said, I believe it's going to happen because people want to know who's coming into their country and they want to control their own trade and various other things. And lo and behold, the following day, it happened. And the odds weren't looking good for me when I made that statement because, as you know, everybody thought it was not going to happen. I think Brexit's going to be a wonderful thing for your country. I think when it irons out, you're going to have your own identity and you're going to have the people that you want in your country and you're going to be able to make free trade deals without having somebody watching you and what you're doing. And I had a very bad experience. I had something when I was in my other world. I have something in another country. And getting the approvals from Europe was very, very tough. Getting the approvals from the country was fast, easy, and efficient. Getting the approvals from the group, I call them the consortium, was very, very tough. But I thought Brexit, I think it'll go down that it will end up being a fantastic thing for the United Kingdom. I think in the end, it will be a tremendous asset, not a tremendous liability. Okay?
And just on the question you asked me, Tom, I mean, I think as the President himself has said, I think we have already struck up a good relationship. But you asked what we had in common. I think if you look at the approach that we're both taking, I think one of the things we have in common is that we want to put the interests of ordinary working people right up there, centre stage. Those people who, they're working all the hours, they're doing their best for their families, and sometimes they just feel the odds are stacked against them. And it's that interest in ensuring that what we do, that the economies, our economies and our governments actually work for ordinary working people, work for everyone in our countries. I think we both share that.
Ordinary working people. Well, pull the other one.
Yeah, ordinary working. What do you think about that? That comes from the Conservative party of Great Britain, right? What do you think?
Theresa May and Donald Trump hope the people listening haven't realised this, but what's really happening in Britain is that the Conservatives are doing everything they possibly can to smash even basic union rights, like basically trying to take away the right to strike. There was a private members bill which was being brought through the Houses of Parliament.
Sounds like union breaking, huh?
Yeah, a private members bill which was saying, well, yes, Brexit's fine, but we want a guarantee from the government that they're not going to go below the minimum standards set in the EU about people's rights of trade unions. So, for example, that the government can't spy on trade unions, that the people are actually allowed to strike, that they can't change the rules as regards to what kind of majority is needed in order to have a ballot, for example, that they can't say, for example, you know, a union needs a two-thirds majority. So this Act of Parliament is a very, very basic thing, which is about looking after working people's rights, you know, and the Conservatives have smashed it. They've filibustered it, talked it out, and it's in it now. Even though Theresa May promised that they were going to allow this and they're going to guarantee it, the actual reality on the ground, George, is that all they're interested in is money, and they're starting to treat people just like commodities, almost like cattle, in order to make money out of them.
Well, you know, you make a good point, Tony. At the World Economic Forum, they talk about this great humanitarian goals they're wanting to achieve for the people of the world, right?
It's all
smoke and mirrors, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, also, to just reiterate, you know, I was talking about the article earlier on. I found the title now. It's Trump, and it's a terrific article by Pepe Escobar. Trump will try to smash the China-Russian Iron Triangle, and he will fail. And this is why, and he explains why. And I think this is one of the most worrying things I've seen, is that there's been indications, yes and no, about just how close Kissinger is to Trump. And this suggests that Rex Tillerson is basically like a kind of Trojan horse for Kissinger in the middle of the cabinet, because he's very close to Kissinger in various ways, but probably the most important is through the CSIS, which is this Strategic Studies Institute, that Kissinger and Tillerson are big players in. They're very close together there, and of course,
He's been surrounded by all of these neocons and world players already, hasn't he?
That's right, and I think there's quite a lot of people hoping, with their fingers crossed, that Kissinger wasn't going to get his talons into, or his microchips into Donald Trump, but it looks pretty certain that that's what's happened. Now, the key thing to understand here is about the swivel to China as the so-called enemy.
The pivot or whatever.
Go ahead. It's that there is an attempt to get friendly, cozy with Putin and Russia in order to try and divide and rule, to get Russia up on Iran, because Iran is the other key country which Obama has done a fantastic job actually in making peace with, because the Iranians are not a threatening people. They're one of the oldest civilizations on the planet. They're very highly cultured people, and they've done extremely well, by the way, under sanctions for many decades, you know. So and also, of course, we had Saddam Hussein, who was put up to a war with Iran by Rumsfeld and the rest of them, you know, all those years ago. There's been all sorts of attempts to subdue Iran. It's all been a failure, really. And I think this is the latest tactic, is to say, well, look, the US is going to scream and shout about China and be all cozy up to Putin in an attempt to sort of divide Putin off from Iran. And what Pepe Escobar is saying is that that is just completely doomed to failure from the start. And it shows how inept the strategy is at the highest levels now amongst the, what I would call, criminal elite in the West.
Right. Oh, I'm going to play our third clip for this evening, and it's about Tulsi Gabbard, and she's a U.S. representative from Hawaii. She spent two tours as a U.S. military officer, police officer in Iraq, and came back and ran for Congress and regained her position again. And she made a secret trip over there recently with Dennis Kucinich. And I just want to play that real quick before we run out of time this evening and get your comments and views on that, okay?
Sure.
Joining me now in a CNN exclusive is Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii. She just returned from a secret trip to Syria. Congresswoman Gabbard, thanks for coming and sharing your story with us.
Hello, Jake. Good to be with you.
So you were in Syria for 4 days. Did you meet with President Bashar al-Assad?
I did. You know, my reason for going to visit Syria was really because of the suffering of the Syrian people that has been weighing heavily on my heart. I wanted to see if there was, in some small way, a way that I could express the love and the aloha and the care that the American people have for the people of Syria, and to see firsthand what was happening there, to see that situation there.
What did Assad have to say?
Initially, I hadn't planned on meeting him. When the opportunity arose to meet with him, I did so because I felt it's important that if we profess to truly care about the Syrian people, about their suffering, then we've got to be able to meet with anyone that we need to if there is a possibility that we could achieve peace. And that's exactly what we talked about.
Now, I know the maxim that people say in the military, that you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. But obviously Bashar al-Assad is responsible for thousands of deaths and millions of people being displaced during this five-year-long civil war. Did you have any compunctions about meeting with somebody like that, giving him any sort of enhanced credibility because a member of the United States Congress would meet with someone like that?
Whatever you think about President Assad, the fact is that he is the president of Syria. In order for any peace agreement, in order for any possibility of a viable peace agreement to occur, there has to be a conversation with him. The Syrian people will determine his outcome and what happens with their government and their future. But our focus, my commitment is on ending this war that has caused so much suffering to these Syrian people, to these children, to these families, many of whom I met on this trip. It's important for us to stay focused on doing what is in their best interest and what is in our best interest, and doing what it is necessary to make that happen.
So, Congressman Adam Kinzinger, a friend of yours, also a military veteran, a Republican, he said on Twitter when he heard about your visit, quote, fact-finding mission, fact, 50,000 plus dead children in Syria. Tulsi Gabbard, I hope you didn't meet with their butcher, Assad. Now, Assad has used chemical weapons on his own people. You said it's going to be up to the Syrian people, but there really aren't free and fair elections in Syria.
I'll tell you what I heard from the Syrian people that I met with, Jake, walking down the streets in Aleppo, in Damascus, hearing from them. They expressed happiness and joy at seeing an American walking through their streets, but they expressed a question. They said, why is it that the United States, its allies and other countries, are providing support, are providing arms to terrorist groups like al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, Ahrar al-Sham, ISIS, who are on the ground there raping, kidnapping, torturing, and killing the Syrian people, children, men, women, people of all ages. They asked me, why is the United States and its allies supporting these terrorist groups who are destroying Syria when it was al-Qaeda who attacked the United States on 9/11, not Syria? I didn't have an answer for them.
Obviously, the United States government denies providing any sort of help to the terrorist groups that you're talking about. They say they provide help for the rebel groups. Tell us more about...
The reality is, Jake, yeah. The reality is, and I'm glad you brought up that point, because this is an often talked about thing by people like Adam Kinzinger and others, saying, well, we've got to support the moderate rebels. Every place that I went, every person that I spoke to, I asked this question to them. And without hesitation, they said, there are no moderate rebels. Who are these moderate rebels that people keep speaking of? Regardless of the name of these groups, the strongest fighting force on the ground in Syria is al-Nusra, or al-Qaeda and ISIS. That is a fact. There's a number of different other groups. All of them essentially are fighting alongside, with, or under the command of the strongest group on the ground that's trying to overthrow Assad. The Syrian people recognize, and they know, that if President Assad is overthrown, then Al-Qaeda or a group like Al-Qaeda that has been killing Christians, killing people simply because of their religion or because they won't support their terror activities, they will take charge of all of Syria. This is the reality that the people of Syria are facing on the ground and why they are pleading with us here in the United States to stop supporting these terrorist groups. Let the Syrian people themselves determine their future, not the United States, not some foreign country.
And we've been showing video of your trip, from your trip. In the minute we have left, tell us the most striking image you have from your visit to this war-torn region.
Yeah, Jake, you know, the destruction is very real, both on the physical buildings and the things that people have gone through, looking into their eyes and hearing firsthand from a girl who is now 19, but who, when she was 14 years old, these rebels that people say we should continue supporting, they came and kidnapped her. They raped her multiple times. They killed her father in cold blood right in front of her and her little brother. All she is asking for, literally, is for the United States to stop supporting these so-called rebel groups, stop supporting these terrorists, so that the Syrian people can begin to try to get back to some semblance of normalcy in their lives.
Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, Democrat of Hawaii, thank you so much.
Amazing. Tulsi Gabbard certainly seems to have the scales of falling from her.
Boy, I'll tell you what. You know, she's a Democrat too, Tony.
Yeah, the scales falling.
She's got guts, man.
On the road to Damascus. This is the thing I think we really need to understand, the momentous, almost biblical proportions.
The road to Damascus. Yeah, well, tell us about that.
This is in the Acts of the Apostles, isn't it? As Saul is traveling to persecute the Christians on the way to Damascus, he has this encounter with an angel and realizes, what am I doing? You know, he has a change of
heart. Right.
And he says, well, actually, these Christians are great people. What am I persecuting them for? And I think that's what's happened here in an amazing historic way. With the post 9/11 war on terror, Western NATO, really NATO backed, or you could call it Anglo-Zionist empire, is finally come to a dead stop and is having to retreat. And I think many people are understanding that all those last 3 or 4 years of propaganda over supporting these rebels, who actually turn out to be a whole bunch of bloodthirsty terrorists, something along the lines of fanatical destroyers of historical artifacts, all this kind of thing, as well as having absolutely no morals whatsoever, so it being impossible to really in any sensible way assign them to any of these major religions, so they're nothing to do with them really, they're just a bunch of chancers. The people are now starting to realize that, and well done to Tulsi, brilliant stuff. And I think
I've never heard an interview like that.
We'll see more from her in the future, I think. I would imagine, George.
She is a sharp cookie, and she's also an officer in the U.S. Army. She spent 2 tours in Iraq as a U.S. military police officer. My gosh, she'd been there on the ground herself.
She has. It'd be interesting to see if she's got much of a take on all this sort of wider geopolitical stuff as well. And I think, you know, also worth mentioning that you've got what with all this talk of Brexit, etc. I mean, there is a positive side to that in that it's about wresting your sovereignty back. It's about taking back control, taking charge of your own affairs. It also
enables...
In Europe, it's a much bigger thing, I think, than in the US, because, we've had our sovereignty taken away with the Lisbon Treaty, with the Maastricht Treaty, etc., and it's beginning to come back to us again. But there is this increasing leaning towards the idea of trade wars. Like I've said a few times before, this is just this use of economic warfare is just another kind of warfare. And you can have a kind of nice trade agreement, but if you start having a trade war, which is what the Donald Trump seems to be talking about now with China, etc., he is in no position to wage a trade war with China. If he does, the chances are he'll lose that war, because the Chinese are incredibly much, much more powerful as a manufacturing base now than they, you know, than they were 20 or 30 years ago. We're also in a situation where we're seeing the rise of the ruble. The ruble is becoming a very solid, stable currency. A lot of people are seeing around the world, for example, starting to do more deals in rubles than petrodollars, seeing that as a kind of, so they're slowly moving away from the old IMF dollar, petrodollar system towards using these, these BRICS, or actually I suppose you should really more correctly call them Shanghai Cooperation Council, their kind of currencies, because that whole power block in the world is seen as actually rather more stable and stronger because it's not so indebted.
Right. President Trump spoke with Vladimir Putin today, and the Kremlin released a news release stating that they talked about stabilizing Syria and also going with concerted effort against ISIS.
Well, that would be nice that if it was true. It would be lovely to see. But they're also talking about these safe havens in Syria, aren't they, which is completely crazy what they should be doing, really. I mean, they're talking about places.
Well, I think Erdogan was alienated from the Obama administration because of that military coup that failed. So he's friendlier to Putin and Trump than he was with Barack Obama. See.
Yeah, so that's a positive thing, and I think
it's going to work together. I think the three of those will work together.
Well, the Turks are actually maybe going to play an important role here in sort of, rather than just being torn apart as Russia pulls in one direction and the US and NATO pull in the other direction, they may actually be able to bring the two together. But then, of course, we've got this whole China thing in the background, as I said.
It's important, and well, you know, the China thing. There's oil in that area, South China Sea area.
Well, look, we've had these various comments, haven't we? I said earlier on about war with China under Trump is becoming a practical reality. This is the Chinese official spokespeople saying this, which is really a kind of... And there's also the Russians are trying to get the Iranians to join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is really... I mean, that would really start to divide the world into two, really, with Europe kind of... Well, Europe is supposed to be part of NATO, although it seems to be... it seems to be a little bit more reluctant these days. So this potential U.S. naval blockade of the Spratly Islands, South China Sea. Yeah. I think Rex Tillerson has talked about that.
Yes, he shouldn't have ever gotten into that at all.
Yeah, it's really winding up the Chinese, and I mean the Chinese would see that, of course, as an act of war.
I tell you, Tony, that they're neophytes, and Trump is, when you have people that are isolated and stranded on airport runways because of visa problems, they didn't think far enough ahead. See what I mean?
Yeah, well, they're not thinking, are they? I mean, look.
They need to plan ahead on this thing.
Tillerson really needs to wash his mouth out with soap saying this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because what's happening is, I don't know if you'd noticed, but the Chinese have moved these long-range missiles to Heilongjiang province, which apparently is within range of the United States now. These, if you want to look up,
oh my god,
be a nerd.
Oh my god,
it's called a Dongfeng 41 intercontinental ballistic missile, and they've been moved. This is because, well, what Tillerson is saying, you know, is
he shouldn't have said anything. That was bad.
What's he doing? You know, of course, he's acting in this sort of CSIS Kissinger Council on Foreign Relations speak, the stuff where they meet in their little private meetings at the CFR, and they come out with all these wonderful things, oh, we're going to dominate that part of the world, blah, 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 and there's no one else, nobody's there to say, well, no, you're not going to dominate that part of the world. No one, they don't get questioned. They surround themselves with sycophantic people who are just telling them, patting them on their back and taking their money. And so there's no real criticism. Of course, one of the other aspects of this, George, really important, this has been missed by a lot of commentators, is the arrest of the journalists last weekend at the Women's March. I think it's six journalists. One last night, the first one was actually released. We cannot have arrest of journalists for covering marches here in the United States or in Britain. It is just not acceptable.
It's not acceptable.
You can imagine going on in Beijing or somewhere like that, yeah, but not.
But in Germany, are you kidding? My gosh.
But taking place in New York.
What's Merkel doing? What's she doing over there?
No, this is in New York. In New York.
Yeah.
At the People's March in New York, the Women's March.
Yeah.
And so this is I mean, there's only one of these journalists has been arrested. The rest are being charged with up to 10 years in jail for covering the march in the United States. Now, this is deadly serious stuff. It looks to me as if there's a... This is, you know, maybe Trump hasn't even noticed this is going on. I would hope he has, because he needs to make sure this doesn't happen under his watch. If you start...
Exactly.
If you start to get machine guns fired at press institutions for covering protests in the United States... What that's going to do, I mean, this can be the beginning of a, it's almost like, you know, a kind of race war style scenario where people start coming out on the streets because they're not being told the truth about, and that if you don't have a fearless journalistic aspect to news coverage, at least of some sort, what happens, of course, is if you start arresting journalists and putting them away for 10 years, then you've got what happens is the news organizations simply have to try and cover these events from behind a desk. They don't dare send their reporters out onto the scene. And this is has a real chilling effect on journalism.
Right.
I think there hasn't been enough emphasis on this arrest of these journalists. I think The Guardian reported last night that the first one had actually been arrested, and they said they're not going to charge him, but they've got five other journalists, including, I think, someone from Russia Today, who they're saying they're potentially now going to be charging them with up to 10 years in jail for reporting on the marches. You know, so, and the riots, effectively. Now, those riots need to be reported, please. We're not going to try and cover up the fact that we've got riots in continental United States, please.
But that's in de Blasio's New York, right?
That's right.
He's Democrat. He's a big Democrat. See,
yeah,
that's not saying much for him. His mayorship.
Anyway, the other thing is, I'd really love to just mention, if you don't mind,
go ahead. We've got about 2.5 minutes, Tony.
Is the release of this information about a misfire of a Trident missile test done by the British Royal Navy?
Oh, that's right, off the coast.
Yeah,
right.
And I mean, we were having a laugh on our radio show last night. Saying,
right.
Wow, is the Royal Navy having a laugh here, firing the missile deliberately in the wrong direction?
We thought the Texans were getting it, man.
They're supposed to be heading to Africa, but we're just going to scare the Americans by firing.
Yeah, we're going to divert it in the air, midair.
You know, but it's not possible that the Royal Navy's getting a bit fed up with the British role in NATO. We're being put up to all these silly things. I mean, you know,
but when we
also,
were in,
I mean, Ian Fleming, of course, yeah. Naval Intelligence, the Bond author, I would recommend you and your listeners check out a guy called Mike Sparks. His website's called James Bond is Real, and he looks at the real Ian Fleming and his real role in Naval Intelligence in the Second World War, and there's a lot of stuff in there about the, you know, dodgy deals which were done by the Nazis. But I think basically Fleming was a good guy. He was told to do dodgy things, but he wanted to, you know, write books which showed some of the dodgy things that were going
on. Well, was he telling us about Scepter? Maybe Scepter is the big deal, right?
Yeah, Spectre.
It's out there.
Is this kind of secret organization behind the scenes?
Yeah, Spectre is it. And that's the Bilderberg and all them, right?
It's another really good series if your listeners haven't seen it. And if you can get hold of it on DVD or on
Oh, man.
It's called Riley Ace of Spies, featuring the great Sam Neill as an actor. That was made in the 1980s here in London. And it is one of the most fantastic series you'll ever see. It's about this spy, Sidney Reilly, who was around about the time of the First World War, up to the First World War, and he was sent into Russia as part of the Russian Revolution as a spy as well. And it's just a beautifully made program, the sort of thing that if only Hollywood was churning this kind of stuff out, or Pinewood Studios nowadays, you know. But it is, if you haven't seen it, definitely watch it, because it's a great bit of history and a great bit of drama too, George.
Well, I tell you what, Tony, well, thank you so much for coming in from Bristol, England, and commenting on all those clips and everything. Boy, you've got some really good insights and everything. And we're about 15, 20 seconds from ending our program this evening. But thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
If you don't mind me just plugging our show, it's thisweek.org.uk. And it's in Bristol, England. We're on Bristol Community FM every Friday evening, and you can download stuff from there, just listen in the car or wherever, because the mainstream is fake news. We're not.
Oh, okay, man. Thank you, Tony, and we've got it all up on the website for you, those click-offs. Thank you for being with us this evening.
All the best, George.
Okay.
God bless. Thanks.
Good night. Bye-bye.